Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, dear to be different. My name is Ismail Briyavanch. It's wonderful to have you tuning in with this via the audio streaming midway 1548 in Satellite Islam. And we are truly, truly blessed. Looking out the windows of Radio Islam Studios, beautiful weather, cloud cover, but a lovely, lovely warm morning. An excellent morning to be out in your garden and to be just tinkering and potting around in your garden. What a wonderful time it is. And this morning we've got a wonderful guest, and that's Andrea Durham, been regular guest with us, and she's going to share so much with us this morning. We're going to talk specifically about fragrance. Plant fragrances play an extremely important role in our enjoyment or spending time in the garden. Sometimes fragrances which gives us pleasure are subtle and we are almost unaware of their existence, as they are stunning as most of the colorful flowers. Important point is the involvement of our sense of touch, which will be well known to anyone who regularly walks past some of these wonderful scented plants. And by simply running your hand through the leaves and taking a deep breath, there's a magical uplifting sensation created by the simple yet beautiful fragrance. Most sections of a plant can be fragrant, but the two major areas being the foliage and the floral fragrances. Timber, roots and bark can also emit a range of aromas, which are not necessarily similar to those of the leaves or the flowers of the same species. We have so many gardens that are planted without thought to scent these days. Perhaps there's been so much a shift to perennials, which are the least scented group of plants. They are missing the third dimension, fragrance, which puts the whole garden into another orbit. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, good morning.
Thank you very much. I was reading some of the things I was looking up for our program this morning, and some of the research has come through, and what is important is that fragrance definitely transports. It is such an important part, and I think the sense of smell is so, so important. Is that true?
I believe that is true. Of course, you get people that will say that fragrance affects mood, and in a way, I mean, I can see it. I'm not sure whether it's the fragrance itself, or whether it's the association I have with that fragrance. But think, for example, of the smell of jasmine in the springtime. Somehow that always lifts my spirits. It makes me feel happy to smell the jasmine in the springtime. Now, whether it's the scent or whether that I'm happy that the winter's on its way out, that I'm not so sure. But that association or that scent is so important. And I think scent is so much more important to us than we realize. We sense a lot more through our noses then we're aware. I mean, for example, they did a test, obviously that is not to do with plants, but it just shows how important smell is and scent is to us, where they blindfolded mothers and they mixed up all the babies and they had the moms try and identify their own baby by smell alone. And every mother went straight to her child and identified the child that smelled right as her child. Now that just goes to show how important scent is to us.
Definitely so important. And the other thing about scent, such as smell, is, you know, it's such an important, you know, sense. You find that when you have a certain smell, it evokes a certain memory. It's very evocative. You find that, for example, it could transport you back to, you know, when you were a child, or it could, you know, be associated with an incident. It could be associated with so many things. So the sense of smell is very, very important. I know that many people say that, well, when I get this, and it reminds me of my childhood days, you know, this particular, it's associated with that. Or when I've done this, I remember this particular smell. And smell seems to come to the fore more than any of the other senses.
In fact, they've done some research on smell and recollection, where they say that smell actually incites sharper, more detailed memories than somebody just sitting and trying to remember an incident.
And, you know, smell is, when you talk about, but fragrance is also very important for the pollinators, whether it's bees, the butterflies, whatever it is. And you find that when it is in the woodlands, in these dense places where there isn't a lot of, sunshine, we find that these are very highly scented, and it attracts the pollinators into this very dark positions. So you find that it is also an important indicator for any of the pollinators, whether it be the butterflies or the bees or any other insect, that they will be attracted not because they can see them, but because they can smell them.
Well, exactly. You know, the whole thing about nature that is so fascinating is that everything in nature has a use and a purpose. And the scent of flowers, although we enjoy it, is not actually there for us. It's there to attract the pollinators. And that's also why the amount of scentedness of a plant changes throughout the day. I'm sure you've noticed this.
Yes, definitely. I think the time you find the most scent wafting through your garden would be early morning and late evening, towards sunset.
You're absolutely right. Because in the early morning, the plants are waking up. They have stored a lot of volatile chemicals overnight. The sun hasn't been shining on their petals. They've got a lot of volatile oils to release. And they release them to attract pollinators that are diurnal. In other words, that move around during the day. So the scent of a rose or the scent of any flower will start off in the morning a certain way, and it will change throughout the day because some of the oils, and there are about 300 different compounds that are involved in the scent of a rose. Can you believe that?
Wow.
And some of them are more volatile than others. So they evaporate at different speeds. So the way a rose smells during the morning will be completely different to the way that rose's scent is later in the afternoon or in the early evening. And then, of course, you've got your early or evening scented plants. They're opening up for the moths and the other nocturnal pollinators. They're even plants that are pollinated by bats, would you believe it? So obviously, that's the time of the evening when they've got to give off that scent message to their preferred pollinators.
So they have a very definitive role in our garden, besides, you know, giving that and the ambience and so forth in your own garden and so forth. But it does have an interest in pollinators. I've seen came across something that was very fascinating. It was that butterflies, you know, people would always associate pollinators with bees. And now you find it's not just bees, but butterflies also are such an important part in this whole environment.
Oh, well, they are. And isn't it lovely here in the late summer, autumn, when the butterflies all start flitting around your garden? It's the prettiest sight. Do keep an eye out for worms, though, because butterflies are usually followed by caterpillars, or rather, should I say, preceded by caterpillars. But then also, you know, be a bit merciful. You know, if you've got a big plant and there's a couple of little caterpillars eating on it, just keep an eye on things. Not all caterpillars are terribly, terribly destructive. Even here where I come from, there's a particular little caterpillar that turns into a rather nondescript little moth. But they do a sort of a group feeding thing, and they strip entire branches. And the one year I just thought, I'm going to leave this and see what happens. And the funniest thing was that the branch that they ate in the spring, and they really stripped this branch, afterwards immediately began to sprout extremely vigorously, and it flowered more than any other part of the bush.
Wow. So you see, we don't even understand sometimes, you know, the role that these pollinators play. And, again, I was fascinated when I found, because, you know, we always associate only, you know, bees and not the butterflies. And now there's a lot of research coming through butterflies and the moths and everyone else. All these other little, you know, insects that we sometimes think, well, would become a nuisance also has a definitive role in the cycle.
It's very, very important. And, of course, another thing which we could talk about for half an hour is bee deaths and how precious bees are. You know, people tend to be afraid of bees. So I've lived with a beehive on my stoop, and I was only stung once in 2 years. And then after I got stung, the owner of the house decided that they had to remove the beehive. But, I mean, it was on my stoop. I had to walk through a cloud of bees. As long as you're not threatening the bees, they're not going to sting you.
Yes, I think, you know, that once, but I think that goes for anyone. If anyone feels threatened, you know, we're talking about human beings, you feel threatened, you're going to react. Same thing with animals and the same thing with insects. If they feel they're threatened, that's the time they would come and attack you. Is that correct?
And I mean, the bees are so important. If it weren't for the bees, we wouldn't be able to eat. But that's actually the reality of it.
And we don't understand, you know, so these pollinators definitely have a role that they play in our gardens. And when we are there, is they minding their own business, we should mind our own and let them continue with what they are supposed to be doing. I think that's the rule of thumb for these little hojas.
Yeah, look, I think we live with nature, we work with nature rather than working against it. There are times when nature gets put too in our face, like maybe also the beehive on my veranda in hot weather. They used to get quite upset.
definitely. And I found that, you know, these days you open up a can of cool drink and the next thing you know, wow, they're just all around there. And again, it's the scent of the sugar. I'm not too sure what it is, but the scent that attracts them to these cool drink cans.
It's the sugar, yeah.
Definitely.
And of course, that's what nectar consists of. It consists of sugars. And it also has to do with the scent of the plant, as well as naturally the pollen.
Well, Andrea, we're going to talk about, you know, how to attract. Now, many people are saying, but, you know, we buy plants these days that don't have the same fragrance of yesteryear, especially we speak to older people and say, when we're growing up, you know, we had those lovely fragrances and we could associate certain plants. Come now, we see beautiful plants, the aesthetics are there, but the smells are not there. And, you know, there's a request for us to discuss how to bring fragrance into the garden and what is the best way and what are the type of plants that would, you know, retain fragrances. What else can we do with some of these plants? And I think we're going to go on that journey this morning. Now, when you talk about scent and you talk about plants, the first plant that comes to mind has been the rose. Now, by association, roses symbolize so many things. But one of the things that many people talk about is the beautiful smells that it used to have. And over the years, we found that they've been hybridized, and many of them don't have these smells. And now people are saying, can't we get those roses that were there once upon a time, many, many years? I remember red rose, and it had this smell, and I remember. And roses were not of many colors in those years as well. So some of those type of things, what do you think is going wrong, and what's the right thing about roses?
Well, I don't know if it's so much a thing that's going wrong. It depends on what you want from a rose. If you want scent, then you have to definitely mention it and look for it when you're buying a rose bush. Because some people are more interested in the color and the shape of the flower. And that's how people develop and breed plants. They breed them for a specific characteristic. So if you're breeding, say, for a beautifully shaped flower or a very unusual color, you might not be considering scent to be particularly important. If you're breeding for scent, obviously scent is the main thing you're looking at, and then maybe you'd also want to have a nice shaped flower, nice colour flower. So I will say that mainly the old roses are very scented, but there are also newer hybrids that are scented. And usually we'll find that roses that are darker colours have a stronger scent, and the ones that have a lot of petals, or very thick velvety petals, they often have a lot of scent. And what's very interesting to me is that red and pink roses often have that more that rose smell, that smell that we think of as a rose, whereas the whites and yellows have got a slightly lighter fragrance, almost like violet or maybe a bit like lemon. And then again, your orange roses have another scent again. It's more spicy. It almost reminds you of cloves. So the color of the rose, what the rose was bred for. So when you're looking for a scented rose, if scent is important to you, if you want a red scented rose, remember that when you're looking to buy a rose, when you're at your accredited Life as a Garden Center or wherever you are, tell the person that you're buying that rose from, you want a red scented rose, and stress that you want scent out of that rose. Because as you have pointed out, not all the varieties have a particularly noticeable scent.
Definitely, and you know, when you get people in saying, and I don't know, but whenever you find a person pass, you know, walking past the rose bush, they seem to bend down, and the first thing they do, well, you've got to watch that. Sometimes, you know, there isn't an insect or bee in there, but when you go in there, people trying to sniff at the rose and trying to get a smell. Have you seen that happening when people pass roses?
Pardon me. Yes, and I think also if you are buying roses in the garden center, the time of year you go will also depend on what you're looking for. If you really know your roses, early spring is the best planting time. But if you specifically want to see and smell the blooms, this is the time, because now the roses will be having flowers on them, and you can go and give them a good look at and a good smell. But do also remember that what you see in the container is not necessarily going to be what you see in the ground. I had one particular rose which I kept in a container for about a year, and it was very pretty, and it flowered nicely, and it had a bit of scent. But recently I planted it out into the ground, and the difference in, I'm talking about 3 or 4 weeks, is absolutely phenomenal. The flowers are twice the size they used to be, and the smell, the scent, is stronger. And in the scent of the rose even changes, I've noticed, if I pick it. On the bush, it smells one way. I bring it in, and it seems almost as if that enhances the smell, possibly because the volatile oils are being evaporated less slowly and disappearing off into the air less slowly.
Well, speaking about roses, do we have, you know, sort of maybe one or two that we could, you know, recommend for a very strong fragrance? I once came across something called the Satchmo. Is there any other particular one that you would perhaps recommend?
Oh, the Satchmo is lovely, and I've got one in my garden. It's a Flurry Blunder. You must also remember when you buy a rose, whether you want to use it as a cut flower or not. Now, the Satchmo, for an example, is a Flurry Blunder. That means that it makes a lot of flowers with few petals. So you get a lot of color out of it. It's a classic red. and it has, as you pointed out, very, very nice scent. But you are not going to get a nice cut rose from that. Then you get the hybrid teas on the opposite end of the spectrum, and they have big single flowers, lots of petals. You do get some very heavily scented hybrid teas. Like, for example, Peace is one that I can think of in particular. It's an old rose. It's a lovely creamy colored rose with a fish-like fragrance. Queen Elizabeth, I'm not sure if she's a hybrid tea or flora tea, but in any case, also a beautiful scent. So your hybrid teas make single blooms, long stems, beautiful for cutting. Then you get the flora teas. They've got the more structured bloom with the more petals. But then, as you can see, it's sort of a combination between the flora bundles, which carry an abundance of flowers, on one stem. So in other words, it branches out and you get four or five dead buds off of a stem. But then fewer petals, less structured flower. Your flora teas are sort of a halfway between the hybrid teas, which are the real, one could say, the aristocrats, the ones that you really pick and take into your house. This year you can cut floribundas. The vase life is just not as good.
Thank you very much. Well, let's rest that with roses and continue to the other favor that people have, and that's jasmine. So you have jasmines of different kinds. You have them, you know, as climbers. You have jasmines of different colors, different shapes. There's some about jasmines and, you know, why is there so many species and varieties? Some of them seem to overtake the garden if you're not very careful. You know, they become over before you realize you've only got a garden of jasmines.
Yes, well, you do need to keep an eye on the creepers especially. There are so many types of jasmine. As you said, there are shrubs, there are creepers. I think we could divide them up quite conveniently like that. Then you have the eastern jasmines, which includes obviously the Chinese jasmine, which is the common one that everyone knows, the little creeper that appears on the, that you can train up your fence or up your pergola or whatever, and it carries those little bunches of white and pink flowers. You get the Arabian jasmines with a much bigger, showier flower, unfortunately quite frost tender, but and quite rare, difficult to get hold of. But if you can get one, lovely. You get the winter jasmine, which has no scent whatsoever, and a yellow flower. That seems to be rather a large shrub, so do make sure you've got enough space for it. But the nice thing about it is that it flowers in the winter when nothing else is flowering. And then, of course, you get the indigenous jasmines, the South African jasmines, and we're very fortunate to have both a bush form and a creeping form. The creeping form does need a bit of help. It needs to be put where you want it to be put. But as I say, even the self-twining form, the Chinese jasmine, you've got to keep an eye on and have it climb, you know, take those little tendrils off the other things they've decided to climb on and put it where you want it to climb.
Well, those are the ones that seem to run around, and before you know, it's invasive, and you know, the whole garden's been taken over.
Well, I think that's more a case of neglect. It's really just they do run along, and they will root as they run. So you need to keep an eye on it and make sure that it stays where you want it to stay. But it's not actually invasive. It doesn't sow itself as such. It just runs, and it runs quite fast. The South African jasmine is a bit slower. It doesn't run as fast. In fact, it tends to sulk for a little bit until it gets used to your soil. But when it does, it's an absolute pleasure to behold. With any climber, do be careful of structures. You know, they get into the roofs and under eaves and so on if you're not careful, and they can cause enormous structural damage. Even, you know, delicate-looking plants can do that. The South African jasmine advantage, you can get a shrub form, which is freestanding. It's got all the scent. It flowers at around about the same time as the Chinese jasmine. Tends to be quite a nicely contained plant, although it is a largish shrub. But you can prune it as you please. Got nice, dark, glossy foliage. But do be careful, as I say, between them, there are two which are the same genus and species, both called mini-petaled jasmine because they have small petals. Also the pink bud that opens white. But the climbing one obviously has a completely different growth habit and needs to be put against something that you can train it up.
Now, something about jasmines, normally you have them in the pale, you know, sort of creamy color, and you have them in yellows. Is there any other particular color that jasmines could bloom in?
Usually they're pink and white. There is, as I say, one or two exceptions that are yellow, and those are usually not scented. But for the really scented ones, you're looking for the ones with the pink buds, open up white, and you get that lovely, lovely sweet smell from them.
So you have the pink and white. The one I'm really interested in, you spoke about, is the Arabian jasmine. Would that be sort of very frost tender or not? And is it available in South Africa, or would be very rare to find?
It's quite rare to find. It's got beautiful leaves, and it is a lovely plant, but it is rather frost tender. I'm not sure. Maybe the people that are in frost-free areas like KZN would find it more easily than I would.
And I'm looking again from the smell point of view, you know, would it be a very intense scent?
Well, all the jasmines are quite intense. So do remember that when you plant them, you might love the smell of a few little blooms of jasmine picked and taken into your house to give off that lovely sweet smell, but you might not want the whole creeper outside your bedroom window.
I've noticed that, you know, sometimes some of these things are very nice when it's a distance away, when it's sort of in your face, then it becomes overbearing and then, you know, you're not sure if you planted in the right spot.
You know, it's like ladies' perfume. We have to be a little bit gentle with our perfume because otherwise we overwhelm everybody, and the same goes for the flowers. Do be careful where you put your scented plants, especially with jasmine. It's very sweet scented. Another one, of course, which I nearly forgot to mention, is the Chinese star jasmine, which can either be used as a ground cover or trained up as a climber or pruned up as a shrub. But that does best in shade. I've seen it growing well in sun, but it likes shade better. And then it produces also... The little white jasmine flowers, produces them a bit more frequently than the ordinary jasmines, which normally just go for spring.
Yeah, just you've touched on a very important point about ladies' perfume, and you, many of our you know plants would be used as what would it be? You know, where they get the scent from, and turned into perfumes. Is that correct?
Yes, of course. Naturally, the most famous one we'll have to return to the roses, and that's the rose oil, the attar of roses, that is famously extracted. Extremely, extremely expensive. Expensive essential oil. So a lot of people, instead of using the rose itself to get a rose-scented oil, use geraniol, which is extracted from the geraniums, the South African-scented rose geranium. There's one particularly with a very finely divided lacy leaf, tiny little pink flower, and once again, with scent, not always the showiest plants or the showiest flowers that have the most scent, but in this case, it comes out of the leaves, and they get a lot more oil out of the geraniums. So a lot of the rose-scented perfumes that you buy are actually geraniums, not roses. Rose oil, certainly, of course, still the gold standard, but the whole extraction process takes absolutely 250 pounds of petals to make an ounce of oil. How about that?
Wow, we'll leave it at that, and it's time for the news. When we come back, we'll continue. Thanks, Andrea. You take care.
Take care.
Did you know that gardening is the fastest growing hobby in the world? Islam highly recommends planting trees and urges people to protect them to the extent that planting a tree is considered as an act of worship for which special prayer is recommended. The Holy Prophet ﷺ said, "Unless you are compelled, do not cut down a tree." So join Ismail Bariava every Sunday between 8:30 and 9:30 a.m. on the program Dare to Be Different.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dare to Be Different. Yes, my name is Ismail Bariava. Just wonderful to have all of you tuning in, whether it's via the audio streaming midway 1548 in Satellite Islam. And we've got Andrea, who is our guest this morning, and she's become a regular contributor to our program. And if you want to describe Andrea, she's an author, horticulturist, one who's very close to nature, living in one of the most beautiful parts of the world. There's so many words I can go on to describe what Andrea does, and she's just wonderful to have on the program. And we're talking about scent. Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Hi, and thanks for those kind words.
I don't know if I've just described it correctly, because I'm looking at Mohammed and he says, what else are you going to say about Andrea? I said, well, I can go on and on and on, and but I must say, I'm just... well,
Andrea, I'm seated.
Thank you very much, Andrea. You know, I was looking at something and it says that building a scent into your garden is one thing, but to get the best from it is not a very easy thing. Is that true?
I don't know if I would agree with that. I think it depends. You know, when you're planning your garden, you have to think about what you want. If you want those wonderful evocative scents of your childhood, you have to know what made those scents in the first place. And then, of course, you need to incorporate that into your garden. Spring is, of course, always the overwhelmingly scented time of the year. And I remember I emailed you and I said, I'm not so sure about summer and late summer and autumn in particular. But actually, there's a lot going on then. And, you know, I just had to jog my memory. Obviously, late summer, autumn, your roses are still busy giving their last gasp. And they've still got some lovely blooms on. Do keep deadheading, because otherwise your roses will stop flowering earlier. And of course, if you're lucky enough, and this is again one of those things you might battle to find, is perennial phlox. But if you can't find the perennial phlox, go for the annual phlox. Yes, it only lasts a year, but it does have this absolutely magnificent scent in summer. And the prettiest, bright-colored flowers, you can get tall varieties, you can get dwarf varieties. So depending on where you're gardening, you would choose between them. And then, of course, there's the alyson, which I'm sure you know, that lovely little thing. Some people call it carpet of snow. That's the old-fashioned white version. And then there's also purple version, the little ground-hugging annual that self-seeds wonderfully in purple, lilac, and white. And that has got a wonderful honey scent that drifts through the air. And that little chap flowers basically all the time. You can grow it all year round, and you'll always get that honey scent. You mass it together. You'll pick it up as you walk down your garden path or whatever. It's not an overwhelming scent, but it's an absolutely lovely summer scent. And as I say, you can do it all year round.
And the name, sorry, ma'am, I'm sorry about that, Andrea. The name of the particular plant again?
Alyson.
The Alysons. Okay, right. Okay, Alyson. Yes, I'm sorry about that one. Carry on, please.
Yes. Well, you know, it could sound like Alyson, the girl's name. In fact, my brother's, whose wife's name is Alyson, he's convinced its name is Alyson because it just smells so nice. It's so pretty. And like I said, quite low maintenance. If you plant it in a place that it likes, it tends to seed itself prolifically. And it doesn't take over, but it just means that although it's an annual, you don't always even notice that you've got the cycle of life with plants dying and coming up and plants dying and coming up, because it seeds itself right there where it stands. So that you've almost always got something going on there. Very, very handy, useful little plant to have in your garden. And looks very pretty, by the way, planted around your roses.
Well, I've got a strange question that's coming. Why do roses attract a lot of flies? Well, it's the first time I see that one.
I've never seen roses really attract flies. I've seen them attract bees and beetles. It could possibly be that there's something else attracting the flies. I don't know if you've manured your soil quite heavily. If you've manured your soil a lot, it's going to bring flies. Unfortunately, that's the one drawback about manure, which is why I like to be a little bit conservative with the manure-based things. I like to do one part of my garden at a time, and not too heavily, and not too much lying around on the surface, because that does draw flies.
If you have any queries and questions, the number to dial this morning, 854-1548, 854-1548. I want to quote you from someone called a scentophile, that's Stephen Lacey. He says, for me, the best reason to grow a plant is its smell. Scent makes connections with people in so many different ways. It switches on the lights from your past, drawing forward little memories. I've always been interested in smells, he says. Do you think that's right?
What a poetic listener. Yes, that's absolutely true. And you know, the thing is that you don't have to leave those scents in your garden. You can bring them into your home. You might not want, for example, your Asiatic lily, beautiful, lovely scent, might get a little bit much at night, so you might want to move the vase. But you can get those scents into your house. And you know what? I found a fantastic thing, because there's one thing that I hate, and that is air freshener. I don't know if you've got the same problem.
Yes, it's got such an artificial smell, and I've got one that's blowing right in my, it's here in the studio, and it's such a, it's not a smell that you can really get.
And it's full of propellants, and it sort of seems to get stuck in the back of your throat and give you a nasty taste in your mouth. I don't know if other listeners have my same hate relationship with air freshener.
Well, I think what we've got to do is make sure we've got lots of lovely, scented flowers around. I think that would sort of sort the problem out.
That's also true, but you can make a homemade air freshener that you can use in your house, and it's so easy and it's so cheap. So I'd just like to share that recipe. It's so simple. All you need is distilled water, a little squirty bottle, not too big. You don't want to make too much at one go, so I'd say about 250ml squirty bottle. That makes a nice fine spray. You need a tablespoon of baking powder, baking soda, sorry. And then you also want some essential oil. So you'll choose the essential oil that you like, rosemary or citrus or even eucalyptus. There's so many to choose from there. There's even floral scents, jasmine oils and so on. And then what you basically do is you pour the baking soda into a little dish and add your drops of essential oil, give it a good stir, put the contents into the squirty bottle and then top it up with water. Give it a good shake and voila, you have a non-propellant-based, non-chemical-based, fantastic air freshener. And you don't even have to add the essential oil, actually. Baking soda does the trick. But I like the scent, so we go with the essential oil.
Let's just repeat that. So it's distilled water, a tablespoon of baking soda, and essential oil. Essential oil, a couple of drops. Would that be right?
Just a couple of drops, because those oils are so concentrated. If you do buy essential oils, you need to be careful applying them directly to your skin. You might want to water them down a bit by adding them to massage oil or adding them you can put a few drops in your bath. But some of them are actually so concentrated that if you put them directly onto your skin, they'll actually create a burning sensation.
Yes, and what about putting into something like maybe another medium, a baby oil? Would that be good enough?
Oh, that's obviously a fabulous one. The oil is lovely, and you can get a lovely scented way of freshening up your skin after your shower. You can add a few drops to your bath. You can get almond oil, which please do not take internally. It's an external oil. Add a few drops to that. You get a lovely massage oil, which you can also use in your bath. So there's a lot of ways to do it. Oil distilling is a complicated process, so the average person won't try it at home. But what you can do with edible scented things, obviously more your herbs and so on, is to get some nice olive oil and put a few branches of whatever your favorite scented herb plant is into that, and then put it in a sunny place. And every day you just shake the bottle, and in a couple of weeks' time you can take out that that sprig of herb strain oil, and you've got a lovely scented flavored oil.
Well, that's fantastic. So that would be the olive oil. Well, you know, if you're wanting to do that with olive oil as well. Thank you very much for that, Andrea. Now, we need to go on to move into some of the other things that we want to speak of. I think let's go on to something that at this time of the year, we have lots of people have challenges around us, hay fever sufferers, and we have the syringa and the wattle. Tell us something about that.
Yes. I'm afraid hay fever sufferers, there is no escape from pollen. Krakatoa, I don't know if you know the story of Krakatoa. It was an island which was...
East of Java, I think. That's where it is.
Correct, and it completely blew up. There was nothing left on it except volcanic rock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they went and tested the air there as soon as it cooled down enough for scientists to get in. And what did they find in the air but pollen? So, yes, pollen travels a long way. Unfortunately, a lot of the invasive plants that we have around here are very pollen-heavy plants. For example, the wattle. I myself suffer from hay fever during the heavy pollen load times of the year, and particularly when the wattles are in flower. The tipuana, which you should not have in your garden, nasty tree for hay fever, burning eyes, runny nose. You can try and reduce it out of your garden by getting rid of some of those pollen-heavy plants, especially the invaders. Syringa is a terrible one for causing hay fever. And I know where you are, there's a lot of syringa.
We have a lot of syringas. They're just sort of, they self-seeded, so every now and then wherever it drops its seeds, you find a syringa coming up.
Oh, they're terrible. If you see one coming up in your garden, get rid of it as soon as possible. If it's big, chop it down, and don't hesitate to use a little bit of herbicide on the stump to kill it down to the roots, because otherwise it just comes up as a coppice. It's a really problematic plant, and it does cause hay fever. Here in the Cape, for us, it's the wattles, and whenever it's wattle flowering season, anyone who's sensitive to heavy pollen loads in the air is walking around with streaming eyes. But hay fever sufferers, again, be a bit cautious about putting your very scented plants close to your bedroom windows. And, of course, there are various air cleaning technologies that if you really have a bad problem with hay fever, you might want to consider. A bit expensive, but can help, especially if you just put it in your bedroom when you're sleeping at night, you're more sensitive than at other times.
Thank you very much for that one. Now, you know, we have some fragrant foliage that releases scents when it rains, when you brush up or walk past them. And two I'm thinking of is the lemon verbena and the pennyroyal. Tell us something about those.
Oh, I love those two herbs. That's a lovely choice. Yes, well, your lemon verbena is a shrub with a rather pretty sprays of white flowers. And then the main thing about it, the exciting thing about it, is the lemon-scented leaves, which are absolutely wonderful. I often, when I walk past my shrub that I have in my garden, I pick a sprig and I put it in my pocket, and everybody says to me, oh, you smell so nice. It's a lovely, sweet lemon.
Cheating.
Natural perfume. Isn't that wonderful? In any case, so yes, it's a lovely thing, and you can use it in cooking, but use it sparingly because the fragrance is very strong. Obviously, here you're looking at sweet dishes, puddings, and especially bakes, chopped up fine. A small amount of lemon verbena can really add to the fragrance of that food. Pennyroyal, again, don't take internally. Not good for you if you've got ulcers. Not good for you if you're pregnant, in particular ladies. So pennyroyal, please, I know it smells like mint, but be cautious about eating it, especially if you have any kind of digestive problem. If you don't, it can be used for sore throat. But like I said, do exercise caution with pennyroyal. It's a very, very harsh herb in that sense. But the nice thing about it is that it's got a wonderful scent, and it's a completely flat growing ground cover, which is very, very handy. Because now what a lot of people do with this is they'll put down some sort of stepping stones or sleepers or pavers or something like that. And between that, they will plant the pennyroyal. And then as you walk through the along the pathway, through the garden, if you're clever, you can also put some things like lemon verbena and so on next to the pathway. People will brush against them as they walk past. And they get this journey of scent as they travel through your garden. It can be absolutely lovely.
Now tell us about some herbs. You know, there's lots of herbs that are also very scented, and whilst you use them for culinary, you could also use them for cosmetic uses. Tell us about some of those.
Oh, yes, definitely. If you suffer from slightly oily skin, then I would very strongly recommend that you have some of the scented geraniums in your garden, particularly one of the rose-scented geraniums. There are several species. The strongest one is the one that is very finely divided and repeat divided. It looks like it's been made of lace. Leaf. That is the strongest rose scent. But there's several rose scented pelargoniums. They're all very worthy. Make a nice strong tea out of that. Make sure you let it cool down enough. And use that as a rinse after you've washed your face. And it helps you really reduce the oily pores and so on. It's a lovely cleansing a mixture for people with dry skin, with oily skin. And then, of course, if you have dry skin, the opposite problem, then aloe is a wonderful thing. Now, you can actually make your own aloe gel. That's not really a problem. Just get a really jelly aloe, like a Ferox or one of those species, cut the leaf and drain the gel. But you can also buy it processed from various places. You can even use the leaf to put it on. In fact, a lot of cosmetics contain aloe because it has a very deep penetrating healing property. So it penetrates deep within the layers of the skin, plus it has the healing properties, and regeneration is the main thing. And of course, everybody wants to stay looking young, and everybody wants to seem to regenerate. They've actually found fantastic results treating burns, by the way, and burn victims and burn scars with aloe, because it helps the skin to rejuvenate. It reduces scarring. So it's a fantastic thing in that way. Then, of course, hair. You know, ladies with lovely, silky hair, we all know the benefit of the right rinse after you've washed your hair. And rosemary, absolutely unbeatable for that, brings out the shine in hair. It's a fabulous, fabulous thing to use on your hair. If you have oily hair, you can use lemon to reduce that. But you'd be a bit cautious because it dries out your hair very quickly. Put some lemon juice on, sit for a little while, and then go and wash your hair very thoroughly.
Well, I think that's been done.
Might just go a bit too far the other way.
Well, now, Sandra, we almost come to the end of the program, but I want to, you know, you tell us about something about the teas, and I know there's some fragrant teas that we can make with these lovely scented plants that we have. And one I could think of, perhaps we spoke about, is lemon verbena, but tell us about some of the others and how should we make these teas.
Oh, there are just so many lovely ones. There's lemon verbena, very relaxing tea. You can also get, what do they call it again, lemon balm, which looks a lot like mint, but smells like lemon. Also very relaxing tea. Pelargonium as well, the scented rose one that we were talking about, also makes a very relaxing tea. So these are nice things to drink before bed. And then, of course, there's also chamomile that's supposed to help you get lots of nice sleep at night. I used to make a sort of a herbal cocktail with all the things that are supposed to make you relax that I happen to have in my garden. And you know, my neighbors used to come around to get some of this because it really did help you to relax and have a good night's sleep. I think it's partly the warmth of the drink, partly the lovely aroma that rises up off of it. If you're somebody who prefers things sweet, don't sweeten with sugar, use honey. And the taste of the honey actually combines a lot better with those natural herbal oils. Tastes much nicer.
When talking about the concoctions, say something, what did you do with this, you know, cocktail mixture? What did you put in? Was it lavender and was it chamomile, things like that?
Well, yes, definitely. I used to light my lemon balm, combine that with a little bit of rose-scented geranium, maybe a little sprig of rosemary just for flavor, but I like rosemary. Not everyone does.
Well, I'm just wondering, rosemary in the tea, I'm not too sure. Carry on.
And mint, mint also very, very nice, especially if you've got a bit of a tummy and you're feeling a bit bloated or something like that, you've had a big meal, mint is the fabulous one. And don't go overboard, you just need a couple of sprigs. Little tips, I usually go with the growing tips because they have the strongest flavor. Pop a couple of sprigs into a cup, pour some hot water over, not boiling, let the kettle boil and then let it stand until it stops bubbling. Then pour that hot water over, leave it to steep for a few minutes, and then you can either fish the herbs out or drink around them, as you prefer. Depends how adventurous you are.
Use an infuser. Thank you.
Be adventurous, you drink around it. I'm adventurous.
So you have them swimming all around you whilst you are drinking your tea, looking to, oh, there comes a little bit of chamomile. Let me see, I can get rid of that one. Is that what you're doing? Andrea, now let's just talk a little bit. You know, you've spoken so much in this. What would be your favorite scented herb that you'd want to bring? You know, let's talk about bringing it into the home. Which would be the easiest herb to bring, or beg your pardon, scented plant to bring into your home?
Well, you know, what is a lot of fun is your in summer, your Asiatic lilies, and in spring, your hyacinths. But because they evolve, you have to sort of think a couple of seasons ahead. So for your Asiatic lilies, you need to think spring, and for your hyacinths, you need to think autumn. And they're lots of fun, especially the hyacinths. You can get the little bulb glass. I think we spoke about this before and watched growing and come into flower. The bulbs are absolutely marvelous. A lot of them you might want to grow outdoors and then bring indoors when they're flowering, so that you can get that benefit of that lovely scent. So, yes, those would be among my favorite scented indoor plants. Yes.
What about the white, paper white? You know, you have these, you know, narcissus and so forth.
Oh, the paper whites, very pretty. Daffodils, little daffodils or narcissi. The paper whites are narcissus. We can have a botanical discussion of 10 minutes on narcissus. But to cut a long story short, a lot of them are very scented. The paper whites particularly have a lovely fresh scent without being overpowering, which makes them very nice for bringing indoors. Definitely look out for the bulbs in autumn. Most of the supermarkets and, of course, all your lighters and garden stockists will have the daffodils and narcissi in. Paper whites, absolute pleasure indoors. Grow them on a sunny windowsill and crowd them. Don't just put one bulb in a pot, crowd them. Pack them tight as they will go. And you get this wonderful bouquet of scented blooms in the early spring.
Well, I've got a couple of questions coming in. And the one that says that how and which plants should I choose when I'm doing a scented garden? Give us a name of two or three.
Two or three for a scented garden. Wow, that's a really tricky choice. Obviously, I would say because you're thinking of a smallish garden by the sound of it, definitely go with the alyssum that we were discussing earlier. That is a lovely scented plant to have in your garden, and you get scent all year. If you've got a sunny spot, rose is ideal. If it's a shady spot, obviously the alyssum and the roses aren't going to work, and there I would recommend things like gardenias, and mint also grows quite well in shade, so you could use that possibly as a ground cover. The flowers of mint, by the way, also have quite a nice scent. So that can work for a shady garden. So many choices, it's so tricky. I love the lemon scented Plectranthus with the ground cover as well. Again, that lovely lemon scent. If you've got space for a lemon tree, don't forget how nice a lemon tree smells, both the foliage and the little blooms. Yes, oh, you kind of a bit spoiled for choice.
Definitely, and thank you very much, Andrea. Thank you for being with us. I've enjoyed it, and you take care. We'll speak to you again.
And you too have a lovely weekend further.
Thanks, Star. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Andrea from Durham and out in the beautiful part of the world, and she's been talking about different parts, different scents we can get from different plants in your garden. And don't forget the herb happening. That's next weekend, and it's at the Herb Farm, plot 264 Summit Road, Midran, and that's the herb happening. And we're open from the 31st and 1st November, the herb happening. This is all from us until we meet again, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.